I'm Christopher Lydon with a special open source literary treat. It's our producer, Adam Coleman, in conversation with the Wordmaster, Ben Lerner, the MacArthur genius who speaks as a poet, a theorist, and a storyteller in everything he writes. Ben Lerner's latest novel, The Topeka School, has been leading lots of 2019 Book of the Year lists. It's the third in a trilogy that includes Leaving the Atocha Station and 1004. Our man, Adam Coleman, has written the only book about Ben Lerner's fiction that was not written by Ben Lerner himself. It's called New Uses for Failure. They sat down in Brooklyn to talk about the emotional charge of literature, about autofiction, which is not about cars, and about the power of language, most particularly in the scenes with high school debaters in the Topeka School, where success goes to the contestants who deploy what's called the spread, a kind of weaponized rapid fire of information.
Would you read a passage of the book, particularly the spread?
I can't really read the spread, but clips of the spread. Have you looked at like YouTube clips? Like really what the listeners should hear is the actual clips of debate. Okay. They are incredible.
That's interesting.
They're so great. No one believes it until they hear it.
The useless damsel result in spiritual poverty and fashion that ensures endless suffering that's labored every appeal.
Preparation of after dawn.
Would have a little loose. Economically starting more, only 20% just states well. It's not a medical intercourse as a possible concoct. Produce significant benefit.
Well, so the spread, right, which is this thing where the kids in high school debates speak as fast as they can to just make as many arguments as they can, because the idea is that if you make more arguments than the other team can respond to in the allotted time, you win, because any argument that isn't responded to is treated as conceded. On one end, it's like a metaphor for just total empty accumulation at all costs, right? Like content doesn't matter. It's just more, 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 more. But also, yeah, I do think it is a metaphor for a condition of information overload where, you know, with the 24-hour news cycle or the Twitter storm, where there's just always this sense of being overwhelmed or incapacitated by information that isn't really designed to inform. It's designed to overwhelm and incapacitate. Or like if you've ever tried to read like a bill from your health insurance, you know that you're not actually supposed to understand all that stuff. You're supposed to just give up on the idea of possibly being foolish enough to like call and argue over some policy that you're never going to actually have access to. So yeah, the spread is a metaphor for the way information can be used to tactically overwhelm. It's also, I think the most pertinent mainstream political example for the spread now is that while Donald Trump's speech is slow, agrammatical, racist dog whistling or whatever, what he really has got is that it's like, it would be a problem to have one scandal, right? But if you have like 1,000 world historical scandals a day, it's totally incapacitating. And everybody's kind of sitting around being like, why aren't we in the streets? Like, why aren't we in the streets today? Well, why would we get in the streets today when, you know, for the scandal that happened at 1 p.m. when we didn't get in the streets for the scandal that happened at 10 a.m. So, I mean, that idea of hiding in plain sight by overwhelming, that kind of notion of overkill, the spread wants to be a metaphor for that, too.
It's like the Three Stooges effect in The Simpsons. Do you know what? Mr. Burns has basically every disease that you could possibly have, and so none of them can fit through the doorway like the Three Stooges, and therefore he's basically immortal.
Right.
Here's the door to your body, you see? And these are oversized novelty germs. Here's what happens when they all try to get through the door at once. Move it, shout ahead. We call it Three Stooges syndrome.
It's sort of that overwhelming you with bad things actually makes you like frozen in that way.
Yeah, it is. It's totally, yeah, it does freeze you. I mean, and then on the other hand, though, the book wants to say that there are these moments of, like, that the spread isn't all bad. What the high school kids are doing is also, to a certain degree, a kind of avant-garde poetry that's recognizing the bankruptcy of mainstream political speech and turning it into this athletic spectacle of unreason in a way that when you participate in it, like when Adam participates in it, he actually has these moments of transport where he starts to feel like he's not giving a speech, the speech is like delivering him. And he just has this experience of pure prosody and the plasticity of language. And that's actually a moment of kind of optimism and possibility.
I have a passage to read. It's on page 22 here.
And now Joanna stands to deliver the first affirmative speech. For a few seconds it sounds more or less like oratory, but soon she accelerates to nearly unintelligible speed, pitch and volume rising. She gasps like a swimmer surfacing, or maybe drowning. She is attempting to spread their opponents, as her opponents will attempt to spread them in turn, that is, to make more arguments, marshal more evidence than the other team can respond to within the allotted time. The rule among serious debaters being that a dropped argument, no matter its quality, its content, is conceded. Competitive debaters spend hours doing speed drills, holding a pen in the teeth while reading, which forces the tongue to work harder, the mouth to over-enunciate. They practice reading evidence backwards so as to uncouple the physical act of vocalization from the effort to comprehend, which slows one down. The judges hunch over their legal pads, producing a flow sheet of the round along with the competitors, recording argument and counter-argument in shorthand, making little or no eye contact with the speakers. During the brief intervals wherein their pens are idle, they twirl them around their thumbs, a signature habit of debaters. To an anthropologist or ghost wandering the halls of Russell High School, interscholastic debate would appear less competitive speech than glossolalic ritual. See the cystic, acneed first negative speaker from Shawnee Mission, his dress more casual, typical of the rich kids from Kansas City, reading evidence at 340 words per minute to support his claim that the affirmative plan will overburden family court, setting off a catastrophic chain of events. He lets each page fall to the floor when he's finished, along with drops of sweat. He inhales sharply, shouts out another tagline, "Overburdened courts lead to civil collapse," then reads more evidence, getting briefly entangled in a stutter that, at such volume and such speed, makes it sound as though he's having a seizure or a stroke. As time runs out, he sums up his arguments, although few of the uninitiated could understand him. Gregor evidence points to backlog courts as a result of increased child support enforcement, judicial overload leads to civil collapse, collapse leads to nuclear conflict, China and North Korea, nuclear strike and ensuing power vacuum outweighs whatever benefits affirmative plan offers, and Stevenson proves affirmative plan no solvency regardless because resistance from internal agencies blocks implementation, must vote no on disadvantage impact alone, but even if you consider plan as plan no solvency, 1AC key source for Georgia courts, not applicable to Fed program, only state level, so there is no way to vote but negative. The spread was controversial. If it happened in front of lay judges, there was shock, complaints. More than one highly ranked team had misjudged its judges and been eliminated in early rounds for speaking drivel. Old-timer coaches longed for the days when debate was debate. The most common criticism of the spread was that it detached policy debate from the real world, that nobody used language the way that these debaters did, save perhaps for auctioneers, but even the adolescents knew this wasn't true, that corporate persons deployed a version of the spread all the time, for they heard the spoken warnings at the end of the increasingly common television commercials for prescription drugs, when risk information was disclosed at a speed designed to make it difficult to comprehend. They heard the list of rules and caveats read rapid fire at the end of promotions on the radio. They were at least vaguely familiar with the fine print one received from financial institutions and health insurance companies. The last thing one was supposed to do with those thousands of words was comprehend them. These types of disclosure were designed to conceal. They exposed you to information that, should you challenge the institution in question, would be treated like a dropped argument in a fast round of debate. You have already conceded the validity of the point by failing to address it when it was presented. It's no excuse that you didn't have the time. Even before the 24-hour news cycle, Twitter storms, algorithmic trading, spreadsheets, the DDoS attack, Americans were getting spread in their daily lives.
Reports the most federal responsibilities federal government invests in that needed to maintain the U.S. as a leader. The Commerce Clause is the basis for exclusive federal jurisdiction. Federal law takes precedence. Funding is...
You've turned to these family narratives, especially in Topeka School, that are also narratives about the possibility of social amelioration. Do you think that art actually is directly beneficial or has the power to ameliorate?
I don't have any illusions about like a book I write practically intervening in the world and, you know, contesting the fascist regression that's happening now or like actually, you know, being a reliable technology that can make something happen. But I do think that every artwork is an argument and insists in its form on the idea that other kinds of meaning and value are makeable. So like with this book, The Topeka School, there are all these different kinds of linguistic collapse, language breaking down under speed and debate, or language breaking down under the pressures of trauma within a kind of therapeutic frame or whatever. And to a certain degree, these are like endpoints of a language. And it's sad and it's scary. It can be about like the insufficiency of a language, but also in all the moments in the book, when someone encounters this moment of linguistic collapse, there's also a re-encounter with the kind of mundane miracle of language as such. The fact that we have this weird technology where by making columns of air vibrate, we can suddenly have this conversation about art and some part of consciousness becomes shareable. So what I mean to say is that I think art doesn't ameliorate in the sense of have some kind of like reliable, practical, political effect. But I think it does, to a certain degree, return us to the fact that, you know, our world is made out of language, which is this crazy transpersonal social technology, which can be refreshed. So I just think it's always an argument that other kinds of meaning can be made. It's not about measurable effects so much as it's an insistence on that possibility of alterity, of things being otherwise. But I don't know. I mean, like, you know, like I'm not at a point of supreme confidence in what a particular book can do. I definitely know that I wouldn't be able to like live in a world, you know, if the only thing we had were the violent pursuit of profit and its images. We do need other modes of insisting that life is worth living and that value is possible beyond price.
A lot of your books deal with bad speech or failed forms of collectivity.
Yeah.
And so is there something about things going wrong that are especially beneficial for this recognition?
You know, it's like the bundled debt problem, right? It's like every once in a while, there'll be this excitement kind of on the left, which is like, ha, there's been like the subprime mortgage collapse has made everybody realize that in fact, they are all socially entangled. If only this bad thing, which is, you know, this huge socialized loss, if only it could be used as a moment for catalyzing consciousness. And so instead of just like bailing out the banks, right, like we suddenly have a new awareness of collectivity or whatever. 1004 in particular, or some of my poems are interested in how corrupt forms of collectivity can be negative figures of their possibility, whether it's like bundled debt or, you know, he mentions, the narrator of 1004 mentions traces of antidepressants in the municipal water, things that you think of as incredibly personal actually like, you know, circulate through bodies. So there is always this sense that even the corrupt forms of collectivity could flip into an awareness of collective possibility. I think with language in particular, there is a sense in which pushing language to its point of collapse is also a moment that's full of like glimmers of possibility. And that's a kind of vanguard, you know, basically a traditional idea about language to a certain degree, right? Like, so that generations of artists will try to push language beyond its breaking point, both to criticize the abuse of language by like a regime or the way language is manipulated in bourgeois life or whatever, like choose your target, but also because it's defamiliarizing and renovating and makes the technology of language itself fresh. Many forms of linguistic bankruptcy are also signs of linguistic possibility. Like cliche is really interesting, for example. Language that's been emptied out of its meaning through repetition. On the one hand, the language loses its power. On the other hand, it's like sea glass, you know? It's like something that's been massaged by all this collective intergenerational use. And when like John Ashbery would write poems, they could be kind of funny or whatever, that really relied on cliche. There was also something like Whitmanic about it. We have these collective figures of speech, however flattened, that remind us of how social language is. So I do think there's a way in which linguistic extremes both have a dystopian and a utopian glimmer. And I was thinking about that a lot in the Topeka School.
You mentioned the Whitmanic quality, and Whitman seems like a through line. There's something Whitmanian about the collision of something super first person individual focused on self and also super attentive to collectives. A lot of people, when they think about autofiction, they immediately assume that there's something narcissistic. Mm-hmm. But I'm wondering how you would explain, you can become deeply attentive to self or to, mm-hmm. you know, personal circumstances, while also being intensely concerned with political contexts and beyond.
Okay, so I understand the idea that, like, if you write about a version of yourself or you have a kind of avatar of yourself or whatever, that it's narcissistic. That makes sense to me. To me, I think the bigger political danger, though, is the white guy who tries to speak for everyone, the mode of the great American novel or whatever. And so, which is a Whitmanic problem. Like, on the one hand, you could say, like, well, writing about oneself, showing the materials of one's life is narcissistic. But I think the much more dangerous thing is the pretension to omniscience. Part of what, for me, writing with often embarrassing autobiographical material is about, is about like marking class, marking privilege, marking particularity, and resisting that notion that I could have perfect access to other minds or totally detach myself from the particularities of my experience. You know what I mean? So, like, there's a way in which, if the question is, like, what's kind of more presumptuous, I think to a certain degree, it's the presumption that you could totally shed the trappings of your experience and write as an other that's a little bit more risky. That's not to say that imagining other minds isn't important or possible or isn't part of what I'm trying to do in the novels to a certain extent. But I actually think that autofiction is sometimes the insistence on autocritique, right, as a mode of approaching the political. Like, so in this book, thinking about whiteness and thinking about the kind of history of the voice that's writing it. But the history of a voice is not the history of one person. The history of a voice is always going to open on to modes of important social interrogation, right? A history of a voice is going to be about race and class and intergenerationality and multiple genders and so on and so forth. So the riskier presumption in the history of white guys writing is to write from a perspective of universality, not to write from a perspective of insisting on the particulars of their mm-hmm. racial and class trappings or whatever. I think the problem with Whitman, or the question about Whitman, the reason why Whitman's interesting is because he's so embarrassing, because he both wants, you know, he wants to be an individual who can speak for everyone, but of course he can't be an individual who can speak for everyone. And what authorizes that project for him is in part being a white guy who thinks that he can suspend all these differences through the amazing technology of the poem. It doesn't work. But the fact that it doesn't work is what makes it doesn't mean that the dream of imagining forms of intersubjectivity or collectivity through poetry is a bankrupt dream. It just means it's a dream. And it just means that the poems always have to be subject to criticism, and we always have to think in new ways about how literature can create a kind of textual commons.
And part of this thinking in new ways seems to be related to feeling in particular ways. You talk about embarrassment. There's a clearly felt component to this. It's not just argument or reason. There is a feeling experience that we're going through when we're dealing with Whitman, when we're reading your novels. And embarrassment seems to be crucial. Your characters, the learner-ish characters in your novels, often embarrass themselves, disgrace themselves. Are they embarrassing to write? Are you embarrassed when people read the books? Like, yeah. this is a question about you.
Yeah, I know. I mean, it's all embarrassing. I think novels are great about embarrassment and shame, because embarrassment and shame often has to do with the disconnect between your internal experience and the social world, right? Like, you're trying to present yourself in a certain way and you fail. And novels are really great at depicting that, because novels can give you consciousness, they can give you internal experience, and then they can also give you the social world. And to a certain degree, I think that's what novels, I mean, that's like a kind of traditional account of the novel. The novel is about the individual relation to the social and social expectations, and the kind of failure to reconcile those two terms, or the effort to reconcile those two terms. You know, I mean, so many of the novels I love to a certain degree are about that. But I also do think that for me, I mean, I've always been really interested like I've devoted my life to a certain degree to like poetry and literature, and I also find poetry and literature to be like baffling and embarrassing and anxiety producing, right? Because I'm always shadowed, just as like when I teach, I find like my students of all sorts are also shadowed by these anxieties where like you're reading the poem and also you're saying, am I having the right experience of the poem? Do I really get it, or is it lost on me? Like you go to the museum and you look at the painting and maybe you're really moved, but also you're wondering, am I supposed to be moved by this? Am I supposed to be moved? You know, like surely I'm not supposed to be moved in the same way by these Warhol silk screens and by this Giotto or whatever. Like instead of thinking about those questions as problems with art, I think of those as part of what art is about. Art is about testing different kinds of value and approach to materials into the world and different forms of expectation. And so anxiety and embarrassment are things we feel when value is up for grabs, right? They're things we feel when we don't know, when like we don't exactly know what the measure of value is. So all of this is to say that I think moments of anxiety and embarrassment, in addition to being really funny or riveting to read about in a certain way, like a lot of the embarrassment in my novels is embarrassment around art, or embarrassment around like the identity of the poet, or embarrassment about the role of art in society. I think that those are really interesting artistic questions. Like, what are you supposed to think or feel when you look at a certain painting? How have others thought or felt? How do you perform absorption, but maybe you don't really feel it? All that stuff to me is a fascinating dimension of art, not a reason to despair of art. And that's the source of a lot of the embarrassment and a lot of the anxiety. It's like with Whitman, like what's embarrassing about Whitman is also what makes him interesting.
What surprises have you come to while exploring embarrassment? What have you discovered while writing these novels especially?
Yeah, it's funny. I mean, part of it is that, you know, like in the Topeka school, like there's this story. It's got a lot of attention, this story.
Is it about the gum?
It's the chewing gum. Yeah, it's the chewing gum story, which is true, just so your listeners know, that when I was a little kid, although certain parts about it is fictional, but when I was a little kid, I mean, I don't remember this clearly, because it's reconstructed through stories, but I wrapped my, I can't remember how old I was very young, and I wrapped my penis in gum, in chewing gum, when I was like first allowed to have gum. What surprises me is that I put that story in the novel. Like what surprises me is that I found myself writing and say, oh, like what this artwork demands here and what like will link up in various ways is this really embarrassing story. Like what surprises me to a certain degree is the compulsion to make literature out of, you know, I didn't like say I really want to share this with as many people as possible. My friend Aaron Cunyon is a really interesting writer and who is also a Renaissance scholar. So he's like studied Milton, has a lot of ideas about shame, right? Always talked about how like you should make art out of the things you're most ashamed about. I mean, writing is so much about bringing forth into the social some domain of experience. It is always about like concealment and exposure, that I think when you're working with materials that already have that kind of like tension built in, it can be really fascinating. But I mean, I've surprised myself just in the sense that I've surprised myself how hard I've been on the narrators of the novels. Like I was really hard on like the young Adam Gordon in Leaving the Hotel, where he's mm-hmm. very hard on himself. Mm-hmm. But I don't know. I mean, so what surprised me is just that I've written that I never thought I would be working with personal materials and literature in this way. Like that was not really happening in the same way in the poems. So, you know, like when the Topeka School came out, I was stomping around the apartment being like, who told all these embarrassing stories about me, you know, that now like I have to talk about in interviews. And I was like, oh yeah, I did. Like I did it. I'm like the world's most private exhibitionist, basically.
Private because
my account of like literature is not that, like I'm not really interested in the abstract, in like literature as a vehicle to confess like interesting or embarrassing stories or whatever. But I have found that the most compelling fiction I know how to make does in fact draw on this biographical material, and also private in the sense that, I mean, I'm good friends with Maggie Nelson, who's written really, you know, interestingly and courageously about her own life. And we kind of talk about it, like we're always amazed what people will say in interviews or what they'll put on the internet, which seems that seems like a kind of like oversharing for us. And then people are always surprised that we feel like it's a kind of oversharing because we've written about intimate things. The difference is that for me, it's all about the way biographical material can be transformed into literary form. Mm-hmm. It's not about just, here's an experience I want to share with you. It's about how can it be constellated into the most compelling artwork I know how to make. And that in a way means it's no longer private. It's part of this like reticulated object. So I'm still kind of baffled and surprised by the degree to which I've used autobiographical material in this effort to make a kind of social object, because I do feel shy about personal experience. And then there I am like telling the gum story to anybody who wants to read the book.
Now, you could have just told readers that this is fiction. I mean, you could have lied and we would have gone with it.
Oh, yeah.
So there is definitely, you are
well,
confessing.
Now I'm not ashamed. Well, also like the New York Times magazine did a whole profile where they made it pretty clear it was that was biographical.
That was the center of that profile. But because right. I'm assuming there are some embarrassing things in these books that are not autobiographical or are not based in fact. I guess this leads to the question of the blurring of fact and fiction. How much does that matter for you in these books, that they confuse readers over what's actual and what is fictional?
Well, it matters in the sense that, like, you know, like the first novel is really concerned with the boundary between art and life. When can an idea about poetry be something you live by, or where do you need to really separate the aesthetic domain and other domains of experience? So like in that book, blurring the boundary between art and life, meaning Adam Gordon as the young poet or me as the poet writing the novel, seemed to kind of charge the book in an interesting way aesthetically. Or in 1004, which is a book that's so much about the way we live by fictions, like fictions become facts in our life, or the way that what we think is a fact suddenly reveals itself to be a fiction subject to change. That whole relationship, again, seemed kind of energized for me by blurring the boundary between fact and fiction. It's not that I'm like interested in the abstract necessarily and using autobiographical material or whatever. It's more that in those projects, it lends a certain charge to the work. Like, it doesn't really do anything to know what's true or false. Is the gum real or not? Like, it doesn't really change your experience of the book, I don't think. But I think the general environment in which you know there's a kind of drama of manipulating or reconstituting biographical experience into the fiction that is the work, I do think I hope lends the book a certain kind of energy. For the Topeka School, you know, it's very much the third term in a trilogy. It's the culmination of the trilogy and the prequel. It again, like I said, it's like a book about prehistory. So I was kind of already in the grammar of those books. Like, I was already in that world of the blurred boundary. And again, the blurred boundary is relevant thematically in the sense that it is a book, like all the books, but it is a book, again, about the way the stories we tell about our past are subject to change, and they can collapse. Like, the fictions we live by can collapse, or they can be punctured, and that's both vertiginous and horrifying. Like, your identity can dissolve, and also an intense form of human possibility. Like, you can not live by the story told by, you know, a bad father or whatever. Like, you can tell that story in your own way. So I guess I'm trying to say that I think it's important locally for this trilogy to try to activate the movable boundary between art and life. But I don't have a position in general in my reading life. I don't look out for autofiction because I'm interested in that in the abstract. I'm interested when that work is really strong, but I'm also very interested in novels in which that's not primary. But I also think it has to do with that thing we were talking about earlier, where I did want to mark, I mean, especially in 1004, which starts by, it's like fictional advance. The narrator of 1004 gets more money than I actually got.
I was wondering.
but I wanted to mark the economics of the book that was, I mean, that book is full of fictions, but the fictions are slightly more interesting if you have to wonder about their reality, I think. But I wanted to mark privilege. I wanted to mark race. I wanted to mark elements of my experience as opposed to disavow them in order to write from a position of nowhere or omniscience. So I also think that's another another element. And that's not prescriptive. I don't feel like everyone has to do that or that everyone does that in the same way. That's just what was writable for me.
You use the word charge, and charge shows up in your fiction. Is charge just that kind of effective experience of electricity? Is that a goal for you throughout everything you write, or what is that charge out to achieve, or is it itself the good?
You know, there's no higher compliment than for somebody to say, like, I felt really alive when reading your book. Mm-hmm. I think charge to a certain degree is just like, I'm using it as a word that means a certain kind of intensity that's at once kind of like intellectual and sensory, that sense of liveness, and that the book that you're reading is an event and not just a description of an event. I mean, you know, that word, like people speak of like an erotic charge, but in the broadest sense of an erotic charge, you know, just like the idea that literature is going to be something other than merely smart or something other than like another argument about how the world is lost. And it's going to be something other than escapist. The word that I'm kind of using, I guess, there is like an intensity of experience or a kind of presence that happens in the act of reading. Charge seems to be as good a word for it as any. I mean, I think about like, you know, John Berger's work, or like a hero of mine like that, who is so politically committed, you know, as a Marxist and as a materialist, but so also committed to the idea that materialism isn't just like an abstract Soviet set of principles. Materialism means being alive to delight and wonder before the material world, right? And that like those libidinal forces have to be harnessed by the political.
A lot of your writing draws from some kind of critical investigation. Sometimes the learner-like character is himself investigating a work of art that's before him. Sometimes the learner-like character's parents are investigating either in the field of psychology or otherwise. There is a critical attention that runs throughout the book that often I think readers would feel might be separate from the charge, from this intensity. We I think, regard criticism as a little tweedier than the charge. What do we gain from bridging those two things? What do we gain from bridging the critical with the intensity of aesthetic charge?
Yeah, well, you're getting at like something that's like what drew me to writing novels. Like novels can be vehicles for a kind of charged criticism. Like, I mean, there is great, I mean, great criticism in like whatever mode is as great as anything, but great criticism tends to be intensely embodied. Like the criticism I love or whatever, like it actually tends to be not just about being able to make like a series of true propositions about an object, but to actually capture something about the texture of embodied looking, if it's looking or whatever. And the novel to me seems to be a great curatorial or critical mode precisely because it can offer charged descriptions of encounters with work of art. It's like where the charge is not just what's in the painting, it's also what the character is bringing to the painting. You can depict a thing, you can depict an artwork as compellingly as possible in the prose, and then you can also depict the encounter with the artwork and all the different epiphenomena that make it important or intense, right? The characters in love and looking at this painting, and there's, you know, horrible social unrest happening at the same time, and there's, you know, the character has like a medical condition that's changed his relationship to time or whatever. I mean, these are things like I'm thinking about like in relation to 1004, which is like so much about like really basic questions like, how would that painting look different if you were pregnant or not? So like that you were carrying this other mode of futurity. Those aren't respectable professional art critical questions, but they're incredibly interesting, embodied, felt. That's what makes art valuable for me, in part, is not just the way the work is always the same, but the way the work is always different based upon what you bring to it. And novels are great for that, and fiction is great for that. It can be an essay. It doesn't have to be fiction, but fiction gives you a lot of freedom because you can make up the artwork if it doesn't exist, and you can make up the conditions if you're not experiencing them. So it becomes a laboratory precisely for charged encounters with works of art.
And at the same time, your books are these intensely patterned narratives of a certain kind of sameness, of you know, the billiard ball that's thrown there has always been there. Right. Everything is the same, but a little different in 1004. There's this sameness that resonates throughout the books. How do you reconcile this kind of intensely patterned sameness with the adventurous ramification that your books also pursue?
Well, on the level of art, like one of the things that's great about a novel, right, is you show the character's encounter with a work of art in the Met, let's say. They're looking at some, I don't know, Byzantine gold leaf. And then 3 days later, that character is walking in the park and a quality of light in the leaves recalls the gold of the Byzantine leaf or whatever. Like the novel, unlike a lot of kind of art criticism, can show you how the return of a thought or a memory at a certain interval is happening in a character's consciousness, right? So like it's a way of depicting not just an encounter with a work of art or a particular conversation, but the way those things recur at different moments in a character's experience or life. And that part of what I think is the kind of art of fiction is the calibration of, and poetry, but in a different way. It's kind of like the intervals at which those things return becomes part of what makes a character. A character is a person who has a certain set of thoughts, memories, patterns of thinking, patterns of memory, patterns of experience. And fiction can be really good at depicting that. So that's one of the ways that repetition and the charge interact, right? Is you have that charged encounter with the artwork in the museum, and then you have this charged encounter with a lover or whatever, and they come into kind of correspondence or relation, and one recalls the other, you know, the way like Proust works with involuntary memory or whatever. So to a certain degree, that's what the repetition is about.
And how much of your thinking about pattern is informed not just by your work as a poet, but also by your background in a family of psychologists? Is Freud's thinking about repetition compulsion something you like grew up with? Did this Freudian or a psychological interest in patterning affect you?
I didn't grow up with like a Freudian discourse, but yeah, like I grew up with two family system therapist parents who thought a lot about, like they would, like if people came over and drank wine, they're like psychologist friends, they'd end up like drawing genograms. You know, it's like a kind of parlor game where they're like, where you're looking to say, oh, well, this cutoff or emigration experience or this thing that happened like three generations ago might help shed light on this behavior that seems to kind of repeat it here, which was, of course, informed by Freud, but also really like, you know, distinct right. from it in lots of ways. But I do think I grew up in an environment in which that what was in the air was the idea that repetition was something that happened across generations, and that demystifying patterns or illuminating patterns would also give you the possibility of altering them. Part of the therapeutic point of drawing the genogram or whatever is to understand a history so you wouldn't just blindly repeat it. So that, I mean, generally speaking, it's not like my parents were deploying a really technical vocabulary in their parenting. It's not, they never really pretended to be experts with us at all, which I'm really grateful for. But I do think it was in the air, was this idea that patterns were significant and that recognizing patterns was a precondition to the possibility of changing them. And that when I started writing novels, family started showing up in all the novels in different ways. And I think that had to do with the fact that making prose fiction is this work of patterning, but also because families are such storytelling entities. The family basically like runs on telling stories about its past and projecting stories about its future. And so like parents started showing up in the fiction in various ways. But I do think I was influenced by being in that environment as a kid.
You've talked about the way we could dream of some better order in art, that might be an embarrassing dream, but the dream is itself valid as a dream. I wonder if you could spell out what a better alternative order might be that art might point us toward.
The Pika School is trying to think about the formation of a voice, right? And it's trying to think about the voice as a like intergenerational technology. Like the voices of your parents are in you, the voices of the debate coach is in Adam, the voices of the popular music of the day, of media rhetoric, like whatever, like it's all there. And to a certain degree, performing a genealogy of the voice, illuminating like what's in your voice, and what parts of your voice, like the narrator of the Topeka School, is thinking he wants to transmit. Like, how does he speak to his daughters? What are the voices that speak through him when he speaks as a father or whatever? Like, the Topeka School does want to say that undertaking the genealogy of the voice and its theaters and its extremes is a way of figuring out what you want to own and what you want to disavow. And one way to read the trilogy, I mean, this is probably as uplifting a narrative as you could kind of get out of it to a certain degree, is that, like, there's that scene in Leaving the Atocha Station when Adam Gordon is at the protest and he mouths the words because he doesn't really know what they are, and he's just trying to kind of fit in, and he's like having these supreme alienation effects. And then there's the end of the Topeka School, where the older Adam Gordon with his daughters protesting the ICE facility is participating in the human microphone awkwardly. He's embarrassed. He doesn't like it, but he's participating. So that there's a move from the kind of ironic detachment, the kind of terrified ironic detachment of that non-deployment of the voice. Like, I'm not even making noise. I'm just mouthing the words of a language I don't speak, to the however awkward, however ineffectual, but still like insisting that another world is possible, the inhabitation of the voice and the protest and that conglomerate of families that are doing the protesting at the detention facilities at the end of the book, which is just a really different way to, or a different relationship to speech and a different kind of like mode of integration. That doesn't spell out another world, but that is a story of progress. That is a story of moving from irony to sincerity, or that is a story from moving from solipsism to the possibility of collectivity on the very small scale that is that artwork. In a more general way, like, I don't think, I mean, sometimes it, like, there are artworks that can experiment with trying to depict a world to come that's better than this one. But I think to a certain degree, like, insisting on art and the kinds of attention that art models and the kind of sociality that art makes possible and the kind of conversations it makes possible, like, it doesn't matter what the content of the particular artwork is so much as the modes of attention and collaboration that the very form of the artwork and the culture that surrounds it model are different than the, like, flattening world of spectacle that only knows how to think about things in terms of exchange value or whatever. I just mean that there are, like, modes of relation to each other and to the world and modes of sociality around art making and the reception of artworks, which are themselves alternatives to some of the other ways we live. You know, like, I grew up with, like, the very compelling kind of Frederick Jameson accounts of capitalism as so total that everything we do is totally dominated by capitalism or whatever. Sometimes I think art is there to remind us that we just have faculties and modes of value that aren't that. You can live in a capitalist society, but still, when you, like, break bread with a friend or whatever, that can be a gesture of sociality or a glimpse of freedom or possibility that is not reducible to capitalism. That's not just the logic of capitalism, even if you bought the bread. And the same way, like, art, without being a roadmap of, like, a different world, is just a moment of freedom or possibility or a different kind of value in this one. And what helps us maintain a position of wonder and possibility is just being able to have those encounters, as opposed to the kind of sameness of one-click shopping or whatever. I mean, I think, like, in a way, like, as we've talked, like, I think the clear answer, like, the reason why I started writing novels, not that I was in control of it, was because it seemed like a place where I could think through the question of the value of a lot of the arts I was engaged in, like poetry or visual art or whatever, and could, like, dramatize my own anxiety and my own belief, my anxiety about the value of artwork, but also my insistence on the value of artwork, and, like, do it in a charged and funny and felt and hopefully entertaining way. Like, I do think that's what drew me to the novel.
So I wrote a book about you.
Yeah.
Well, about 1004.
Yeah.
As I wrote it, you were pretty much a character in a book I wrote. Yeah. And I'm wondering what that's like to see yourself not just be written about, but become this character that becomes a subject of criticism, of critical analysis, of study.
Yeah. Well, I'm really flattered by, like, by and interested in, and also blinded by. There's like your writing, or David Shields, it's a very different lay, but like in a book, How Literature Saved My Life, where he kind of takes up the character. I mean, in a way, like I end up not identifying with the narrators of my own books because I, of course, have a sense of what's fact and fiction, which is less available to other people. But I think that's what literary character is for. Like a literary character is like a technology of thinking. And so it's really exciting to see it get caught up and become a medium for somebody else's thought. And I also think that since novels like these are so self-reflective about their own construction and processes, that they kind of, they're already to a certain degree works of autocritique, and that can spread in new ways. I love the idea that the Adam Gordon character can have an afterlife as an instrument of someone else's thought, but it actually makes it less personal for me in a good way. Like it doesn't feel like it's about me. It feels like it's this thing I made that lives in a book, having a life in another book. It's like pleasantly impersonal because it makes so clear the degree to which the character is separable from my biography and can become an instrument of someone else's thinking.
That was the novelist, poet, and critic, Ben Lerner, who wrote the hot novel, The Topeka School. He was speaking with our producer, Adam Coleman, whose book about Ben Lerner's 1004 is titled New Uses for Failure. There's more at our website, radioopensource.org. Find the rest of Adam's conversations with writers such as Alyssa Quart and Joshua Cohen by joining our Patreon community at patreon.com/radioopensource. I'm Christopher Lydon. Thank you for being part of the Open Source Conversation.